The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your make the block bump of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
The music is a magic of a secret world. It's a world that is always.
I get a lot of notes asking for more jazz. I do. And we are here to provide. We're here to provide more jazz this week. We're going to talk, primarily, we're jumping off today from a piece that was written by Gio Russinello, who writes about jazz for us. Gio's here. Gio, what's good? How are you?
What's up, John?
Gio wrote a piece a couple months ago about jazz in non-traditional spaces, moving beyond the jazz club, etc. We're going to talk about that. We're going to use that as a jumping off point for a larger conversation today. We are also joined OG gang, Nate Chenin is here. Nate, what's really good, man?
John.
Woo!
I feel like I'm visiting an old haunt where the parties just kept going and I'm like, hey guys.
He's back. Okay.
I'm back.
So first of all, Nate used to write about jazz for the Times. Like, y'all know that. Nate's been on podcast a bunch. Nate wrote a book, Playing Changes, Jazz for the New Century. Nate is the editorial director at WBGO, a contributor to NPR Music. We got big jazz brain trust energy here today. Just a lot that's going on. And also, like, crucially, and I think, and Nate, we were talking about this just a touch before we started recording, like, outside in the club, seeing what's happening in real time. And this is part of what Gio's piece was about, is the evolutions in what that means for younger jazz musicians, for younger jazz fans. And I will say, I know this is maybe the weird point to start with, but when I was looking at the photos that went with your piece, Gio, I was struck by how unstructured, how loose, how intimate those rooms felt. And obviously doing a really vivid job of capturing what you're writing about in that piece. Maybe can you, first of all, we were starting with a Melanie Charles song. It's called Music is the Magic. That's, and Melanie is the main photo at the top of the piece. Can you maybe just give us a précis on what you were talking about and why now you felt was the moment to dive in on this? To what degree does it have to do with evolutions in the New York jazz club ecosystem? To what degree does it have to do with COVID and people finding unusual ways to congregate? Talk us through the kind of basics, and then we'll go from there.
There's a few registers on which I was thinking about the idea of jazz living in spaces outside of the club. And on one level, it's a historical phenomenon that has always existed in the music. Musicians have always kind of made their own spaces to perform in. They've also been down to play wherever. Obviously, we do have a romantic attachment to the notion of the jazz club as not only a part of the jazz iconography, but part of the American iconography, the American cultural lore of the 20th century. But I do think coming out of the pandemic, we're looking at a moment where people are thinking about pressing reset or at least exploring new opportunities when it comes to space and gathering, for obvious reasons, not limited to the pandemic itself, but in fact, the shifting of real estate markets, the way that people have made big decisions about whether to stay in cities or leave, which has affected the amount of available spaces in cities, which has also affected the audience gathering that goes into like creating a space. All of those things are happening, but they're happening at the end of a line of, I would say, about 15 or 20 years in jazz, where something new has been brewing, some new energy has been gathering, and it really has come to a head right around this sort of 2020-2021 moment. And the great irony is that, like, this music that is sort of having a renaissance and a revival in the work of musicians like Melanie Charles, people across the pond like Chewbacca Hutchings and Nubia Garcia, musicians here who are sort of towing the line between what's hip and what's hip-hop adjacent, and also what's more on the avant-garde side, musicians like James Brandon Lewis. All of this stuff was already ready to pop off and was already starting to do it. And then we had this moment where, oh, it's so cool, everyone's into live music, like that you have to go out and hear again. And now we have a pandemic. So the question of coming together and gathering around that stuff is itself going to be a complex one. Answers still in formation. All of that kind of rich opportunity to take a beat on things in motion that makes you want to write an article. So I sort of thought, okay, now's the moment. And the more I looked into it and the more I talked to musicians, the more I actually found out about a lot of frustration around the club scene, the limitations of the club economy, things, ideas that are not new, experiences that for musicians are not new, but that maybe at this moment of reconsidering, they're all kind of thinking, okay, maybe something new could come out of this.
I couldn't help but think, reading your piece, I feel like, Nate, you and I had a versions of this conversation 2016, 2017. And one of the interesting things about the pandemic is I think it really underscored, I mean this in like a amusing way while eliding the kind of traumatizing way, but it really underscored the lies that we've all been telling ourselves for years and years and years and years about the way things need to function. What makes a good podcast? I would have told you we would have had to all be in the same room. And yet here we are in three different cities having a conversation. Everything that we thought was the accepted norm no longer is. Nate, I feel like we were having conversations years ago about the jazz club being ready to be reevaluated / undermined / evolved. That was already happening. Talk about that.
That conversation was definitely underway. The pandemic, as we know, in so many aspects, was a great opportunity to reevaluate conventional wisdom, to think about what's more sustainable, what's more equitable. That said, so here's where I'm going to push back just a little. So I really appreciate the level of reporting, Gio, that you brought to this piece. And it's the kind of piece that I strove to do when I was at the Times. I think you really bore witness to a lot of important stuff. My yes, but to that.
I love to be buttered up like that, Nate. Yeah. Can we do a little more preamble before you bring out before you sharpen the knife? Come on.
Maybe we should put our cards on the table for a moment here, because Gio, you come to this not only as a critic, but also as an arts presenter in the community, but with a kind of like roving, not a dedicated space, but like roving, you know, you've been moving around the city of Washington, D.C., presenting music in all kinds of different spaces. And so you come to it with that sensibility and that feeling for the connection between an artist and an audience and how it can be cultivated in these different ways. I come from a situation where my parents were nightclub entertainers and I was literally like weaned in clubs. And so it's like in some weird, like deep tissue way, like clubs are a part of my experience. And I have as much sentimental attachment to them as you can without tipping over into something unhealthy. So when we talk about the pandemic, I mean, we lost so many important jazz musicians to the pandemic in 2020. And we also lost an important gathering place in the Jazz Standard. And I have to say, like, losing the Jazz Standard felt indistinguishable for me almost from losing like one of these people, because it was like, this is not just a space of commerce. This is not just where you go to hear such and such. Like, there was actually this kind of life force in this physical space and in all of the investment in it, the community around it. And the flip side of that coin is that I recently went up to a construction site, which will soon reopen as Smoke Jazz Club in the Columbia University area on 106th and Broadway. And the owners of Smoke took this pandemic time to really like fix all of the things that bothered them about the club prior to closing. They like took their time, they expanded, they've created what I think is going to be received as like a great improvement, but also as like a space that is more conducive to the hang.
For those who don't know, is that a new location or is it just an expansion of a pre-established location?
It's an expansion. So Smoke has been open in that spot since 1999. And before that, it was a previous club called Augie's. Smoke is this spot that has been really nurturing to an older generation of like mainstream swinging, you might say traditional jazz artists. And it's kind of pricey and it's like, it's got all of the like accoutrement of the old school way of jazz clubs. Part of what they've done with this renovation, they've taken over the adjacent space, created a lounge that's going to be just open to the community with no cover. These two spaces will be connected and they'll be symbiotic, but they'll be separate. So you can actually go to Smoke and just hang out and just soak up the atmosphere and be near the music. And then you can like spend the money and go into the listening room. And so it strikes me as like a really smart adaptation to sort of some of these things we're talking about. But it's meaningful to me that it is still this space that has this tradition and this weight of history. I still like the rituals of the jazz club. I still like that it's a space that has a certain kind of implicit code of conduct. But it's important to me that the status quo in these spaces has actually opened up and bent in the direction of a younger, more diverse coalition of artists.
Here's a question that has been ping-ponging around hearing both of you talk about the different sides of this. Would you say, and Gio, maybe this is more based on your conversations with the musicians in that piece, folks like that, you know, your Julius Rodriguez, Casa, like that scene, are they attending shows, like casually attending shows at the more traditional rooms, at the Vanguard, at the Blue Note, at Old Smoke or New Smoke? Or is it literally just two completely separate worlds that do not at all intertwine or discourse with each other?
There's just so many factors that are intertwined and at play here. But to answer your question pretty directly, yeah, cats are still coming out to clubs and still making the hang to a certain degree. Like I was at the Vanguard a couple weeks ago to catch Logan Richardson and his quintet, Lose People. He's one of the greatest alto saxophonists of the, I guess he's in his probably early 40s at this point, like of that generation. His music is a fusion of almost like thrash, metal, gospel, blues all together. It's a really, and it makes you feel like you're levitating. I mean, this music is so strong and powerful. It just like blew our hair back.
Can we hear some Logan Richardson?
Absolutely.
Do it.
Yeah, let's throw some in there. Something from that Blues People record.
Yeah, Blues People is the one.
All right, let's get into some Logan Richardson from Blues People. This is Anthem.
So Logan was playing this set at the Village Vanguard, the 85-plus-year-old totem of the jazz scene in New York. Logan Richardson is hanging in the booth along the side, sort of in the shadows, just kind of catching it low-key. Somebody recognizes him at the end, and then he, like, gets swarmed by a few people who are like, oh, Julius, like, congrats on the new album and everything. It's the old vibe of, like, oh, that's the hang. But I would say it was notable to me that that was the sparsest show I had been to at the Vanguard in years, in terms of attendance, and it was the best show that I had been to at the Vanguard in years. So there did feel like some kind of disconnect. And I sat there thinking, ooh, I wish I could write a review of this. I wish I'd thought ahead and made a case and blah, 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 because I would like to really lend some support so that the Vanguard doesn't give up on this because it was so sparsely attended. And there was that feeling of square peg, round hole, a little bit. Also because I don't think the audience necessarily entirely knew what to do with that music sitting down in wooden chairs. I think there was a lot in that music that was asking them literally to get up off the ground and like be in motion with it. So that's just one sort of vignette example.
I think it has to do with how do you form that bridge? We recently lost Megan Stibiel, the founder of Revive Music Group. And throughout the 2010s and into the 2020s, this is an organization that really, it made that connection between both conventional and unconventional spaces and audiences who didn't know they were jazz fans, but were kind of ready to get that message. And, you know, when I think about the legacy of Revive Music Group, it's borne out in the careers of people like Brandy Younger, the harpist, and Logan Richardson, and Derek Hodge, and Marcus Strickland, you know, all these people who have...
Even Thundercat.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about like, and John, I know you've been paying attention to this, that like the kind of the change in the discourse around jazz, especially for young Black audiences, it's been this thing that we could actually watch happen. And it happened in no small part because of the tenacity of Megan Stabile and Revive Music.
One thing that does bear mentioning is that Revive recognized that a lot of the music that was being made on this scene maybe belonged in the pages of a Fader or a Complex or a Pitchfork, but wasn't there yet. And a lot of the stuff that she published emulated that. And you talk about it as advocacy journalism, Nate. I think it was also kind of modeling for these more mainstream outlets and these more crossover or pop or hip hop outlets that it would be cool to advocate for this music. So like giving Ben Williams's record like a 10.0 or whatever before he was on anybody's radar was like a way of saying, hey, Pitchfork, what's up?
I was thinking about this in terms of our venue conversation. Robert Glasper, who is kind of the closest thing to like a superstar that we have in instrumental jazz now, you know, he collaborates with vocalists, obviously. He's now the guy who took over Chick Corea's perennial role as like a month-long artist in residence at the Blue Note, which if we're talking about like the commercial jazz club experience, like you can't get more that than the Blue Note. And yet when Glasper is in residence there and you've got all kinds of rappers hopping on and off and you have Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock like popping up every other night, it takes over. It becomes this whole other energy. And so it's almost like they're using this conventional space and they're remaking it in their own image.
I feel like that happens more at the Blue Note, like just looking at the monthly calendars, that's more apt to happen at the Blue Note than it is at some of the other rooms. And I wonder, is there a particular booker? Is there a sense that the Blue Note can play with tradition in a way that maybe the Vanguard can't? Like, is that what the discourse is?
Well, some of it comes down to infrastructure and money. You know, some of it comes down to resources. But I do think that there are a couple of people involved in the booking who are just like, they're down with this. It's not that different, really, from what Chick Corea used to do there. But it's a completely different demographic that comes out. So, you know, if Chick attracted a kind of boomer and post-boomer jazz audience, Glasper is you just shift it down the line. It's like Gen X and younger. And it's a much more Black audience, for sure. But it comes down to like, can this person create an entire vibe? You know, and Robert has proven that he can do that with all of his different projects.
My question is, do you think the Blue Note is where he cultivated that?
No, it's not where he built it. It's the victory lap. And so as we talk, and your piece, Gio, is so much more about like what's bubbling up from street level. But as we just think about spaces, it's so interesting to me that these spaces can be hijacked, you know?
So Nate, basically what you're saying, because a lot of what Gio's writing about, like you say, it's bubbling up, it's bottom down, it's where are the most restless folks among us congregating in order to carve out a new sound or a new position. What you're saying is actually kind of coming from the opposite direction, which is like, there are going to be folks from that scene who graduate to bigger audiences, more money, better tours, better record deals, etc., but who still want to agitate. And they can use the tools that used to seem like impenetrable or unusable. They can use those spaces to continue to agitate.
Yeah. And I just want to point out that, and John, I hope this is on your radar. This has all the makings of a John Caramonica Hits the Road assignment right here.
I love it.
Are you familiar with the Charles Krug Winery in the Napa Valley?
No.
You must be.
No, what's going on?
This festival is going to be sick, man. This festival is going to be nuts.
What's the vibe?
From July 29th through 31st, the Blue Note Jazz Festival is taking over in the Napa Valley. And listen to who's playing, all right? I'm just going to start reading names. Chaka Khan, Kamasi Washington, Madlib, Dinner Party with Snoop Dogg, Black Star, Thundercat, Flying Lotus, Keon Harold, Maxwell, Corrine Bailey Ray, Emily King, Chief Ajua, formerly known as Christian Scott, Dave Chappelle, Butcher Brown. I mean,
what?
I could go on and on. Erykah Badu with Robert Glasper. It's at a winery in Napa Valley, and it's sold out like instantly.
Where are we staying? We getting an Airbnb?
I don't think if you ask musicians, like the musicians who are really thinking about what their music means to them and to their community and to like their listeners, I don't think that any of them would say that their like main artistic goal or their main spiritual goal is to play Napa Valley winery festivals or rooms full of tourists in Lower Manhattan.
There are some smooth jazz musicians who really aspire to the winery circuit.
Thank you.
The winery circuit is like a real thing.
It is.
Gio, you've been largely spared this, but like when Nate was writing for us, literally 2, 3, 4 times a year, I would just basically be like, please write about smooth jazz. Like I'm begging you to write about smooth jazz.
Nobody in the history of the New York Times has ever written more about smooth jazz than I did.
Yes. And I am proud to have been a tiny nudge, I should hope.
This is my blindness. I just think I skipped right past those pieces, Nate, and I read pretty much everything you wrote. So
I couldn't be more proud of our smooth jazz coverage.
I think it must have set off your antibodies, Gio. Yeah, you were just like...
Seriously, where's the Boney James Lost review? I need to go back and
Boney James,
and
yo,
research.
Boney James. First of all, Boney James, shout out my boy Nick Sylvester. He knows what it is. Okay. Gio, okay, there's the tourist jazz club downtown into winery circuit, like getting absolutely lit while listening to incredible jazz. Do you think the musicians that you're writing about in this piece, do you think that there's a schism? Are there some who'd be perfectly happy to graduate to that world and some who are actively agitating against it and on some, frankly, on some punkish, like just being like, never, not like the photos of New Blue in your piece are like very triggering for me because I've been at any number of parties at New Blue in the last 10 to however many years that are all like that. It doesn't matter what the genre is. They've been hip hop shows. They've been rock shows. They've been dance nights, jazz things, but they're all the same paint scraping off the wall, just rough. But there are some folks for whom that's the kind of ne plus ultra of the thing. So is there a schism going on?
The whole notion of like performing music in physical spaces in a somewhat live fashion is a fraught one right now, because really the question musicians usually are asking themselves is, you know, the musicians that we really listen to and that we really like appreciate, I think, are the ones who are thinking to themselves, maybe on a cognitive analytical level, or maybe just on a sort of a more basic level, how do I channel what I feel right now in this moment into my music? Like, how do I actually convey the sensation of being alive at this really screwed up time as a musician? Those musicians, the ones who really want to, and I think Logan is a great example. I certainly think Melanie is a good example. The list goes on and on. Those musicians are looking for environments that basically can let them feel like themselves. And I don't know that a lot of young musicians, some young musicians who come through the pipeline of the education space and who like kind of have what a lot of us in the jazz world share, which is like a level of kind of appreciation for like a literary cum musical tradition, like don't really worry so much about being like elevated out of the mainstream and it's fine. They play clubs because those are sophisticated spaces and they make sophisticated music. So certainly there are musicians who simply accept that. But I think there's probably now more and more musicians who, considering that like everyone is putting to the test the means of production, like the ways in which we're doing this stuff, you know, everything is coming in for a needed reconsideration. I think musicians and artists overall are thinking like, do I even want to be showing in that museum? Would I rather be putting on my own shows in galleries with my friends? Or like, what is gained and what is lost by playing for wealthy patrons who are seated and who may or may not know the quote unquote code of etiquette of listening to music at a jazz club? And frankly, a lot of musicians don't even care about that code in particular. They'd rather have loud, rowdy, you know, excitable crowds.
The Queens Museum had a gala recently where it was honoring a couple folks, one of whom is Tremaine Emery, who is now the creative director of Supreme. Like an incredible crowd, great art, fashion, extraordinarily diverse, loads of folks from Queens, like not a kind of like Manhattan gala crowd at all.
Yeah, no, that museum is specifically dope for that.
The entertainment was Emmanuel Wilkins. But unfortunately, by the time it got to Emmanuel Wilkins, I think people had kind of checked out. And I was like, low key, I would love to see if everybody in this room standing up, fully engaged with Emmanuel Wilkins, who is probably steering a little bit more to the straighter rooms than the looser rooms. And I was like, what an incredible opportunity this would be. And it didn't feel like it totally gelled, and that was a bummer. But I was excited to see that he was on the bill. And I was like, I really wonder how it's going to play in this room. But by that point of the night, you know how those things can get. It's like people had like checked out a little mentally, which is unfortunate because Emmanuel Wilkins goes.
He is a fascinating test case, John, because over the last 2 years, we've been kind of in fits and starts. We've been returning to live music and now we're kind of back. But I don't think I saw any single musician more and in more different circumstances than Emmanuel. And part of it was because he put out this incredible album in 2020 that, Gio, I think you made your number one album that year. And then he was supposed to tour behind it. And we know what happened. All plans set aside. And so he never got a chance to tour his New York Times number one album. I saw him in a cemetery. I saw him in a warehouse. I saw him, you know, in a proper club. I saw him on multiple live streams.
I was in your hometown the other day, Nate, and I was walking. It was at something called Porch Fest in West Philly, where people just play like mostly. It's like in a very, very cool, mixed, very queer neighborhood of West Philly. And I'm walking out. I'm just there to see my friend play on his porch as part of this sort of like day long, like informal DIY music festival. But I'm walking out of like a roti spot with like my lunch in my hand, and who's walking past but Emmanuel Wilkins. I'm like, what are you doing, man? He's like, oh, I'm just going to play on this porch over here. And I'm like, you, Emmanuel Wilkins, are just going to play on this porch over here?
Emmanuel Wilkins is to live performance in 2022 what like Lil Wayne was to mixtapes in like 2005.
Yes.
Emmanuel put out an album this year, right? Can we listen to something off that album?
I have a recommendation. This is going to sound like self-promotion, but check this out. Earlier this year, Emmanuel played an album release show at a DIY punk club in Philadelphia. And this was presented by the Ars Nova Workshop, which is a nonprofit presenting organization run by a good friend of mine that has not had a venue historically. And so you have to imagine that this is like Emmanuel and his band on this like little punky stage. The crowd, it's a standing room crowd, it's a sweaty room, and that's the vibe. And so Jazz Night in America had a crew there, and we put it together, we filmed video, and we published it. So let's pull some audio from that.
Let's do that. Let's listen to that, because that's the energy I think I was low-key hoping this thing a few weeks ago was going to like morph into, and maybe didn't quite gel. But yeah, let's get into it. Jazz Night in America, Emmanuel Wilkins, DIY, punk, warehouse, Philly, let's go. And then we're going to take a quick break and be right back.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. Nate Chenin, Gio Russinello. We were just listening to Emmanuel Wilkins at Philomoka from earlier this year. Gio, some of the folks in your piece who seem committedly whether it's philosophically opposed or structurally denying all this other stuff, like people who are more than content. Like, you know, I saw Casa Overalls in your piece, like obviously been moving in these kinds of spaces for a long time. Can you talk me through a few of these key figures and a couple more of the New York specific locations? Like, you know, I see Cafe Erzuli, which I think also does like Afrobeats nights and so on and so forth. Talk through some of the players and the places.
I'll pick up on Nate's description of actually what we describe as a victory lap, or sort of like the vaunted space that you can kind of get to maybe at the end of the line if you're successful enough to bring this energy back around. So you were talking about going to Glasper shows at the Blue Note and feeling like it was cool that there was enough support there. It made monetary sense for the club to get behind it because they have the resources to make it so that, like, when I go see Glasper, ASAP Rocky ends up being on stage with Denzel Curry and like they're just jamming out, right? Or like Black Star reunites around a Glasper concert, you know, and like those are incredible moments. And the crowd is super there and Glasper knows what it's like to animate that space. But a lot of the same energy is maybe on a slightly lower to the ground level happening at spaces like Nublu, right? Which you mentioned, John. And where you've got somebody like Raymond Angry, who has worked with D'Angelo, has worked with so many musicians from across that scene, and brings essentially a kind of jazz musician's mind and a contemporary pan Black diaspora musician's ear to those gigs. So he's inventing all the music from scratch in the process of the jam session. It's heavy on backbeat groove loops, reggae kind of rhythms mixed with tremendous jazz solos from Ray and a bunch of the other musicians in the band. So that's happening at Nublu every Monday night, where he's got a residency that's lasted for years and where it's frankly, like, surprisingly always packed. They start like 2 hours late and it's always full. Like, it's a serious vibe that goes into the wee hours every Monday night. Then there's places like Cafe Erzuli. I mean, there's always been just a plethora of spaces that may or may not conform to any particular model. I think nowadays, musicians like who I mentioned, James Brandon Lewis, who are being more kind of cultivated by a avant-garde scene, that's an example of a scene that's been used to being excluded from the clubs and has already been born of its own aversion to that model. Avant-garde came out of the womb like as an alternative to that jazz club energy. So it's no surprise that it continues to happen in community centers, to put on a lot of concerts in parks these days, something that we see in cities all across the country. A lot more outdoor shows for obvious reasons, but that also sort of starts to lead us toward other conversations, right? Like, there are ways in which you can do really hip-ish in clubs that are not jazz clubs, but are venues that feel natural to, like, pay a cover, walk in, you know, standing room, order yourself a drink. That's cool. But then there's also an evolving and I think more emergent conversation picking back up on what was happening in the 60s and 70s around community events, outdoor events, the music being something that's not too hip for its own good or too cool for school, but in fact is about like bringing members of various generations together around free presentations of great music. And that's something that actually at the end of 2020, I kind of wrote a capstone piece thinking about like how much great music I had seen being played out in public. So I think there's a lot of factors conspiring to turn stuff upside down a little bit. Casa Overall is a nice segue back into talking about Megan Stabile, who Nate had mentioned and who we really, really sadly lost just a few days ago.
I was going to say Ray Angry is another bridge there.
Huge. He was always on her shows. I believe he was hosting the jam sessions that they did for a while, or there was definitely like a continued relationship there. But when I spoke to Casa Overall for the piece that we've been talking about, throwing some questions around about the role of the jazz club these days, he and other musicians too made pointed mention of Megan's role and how much she had really paved the way for musicians to believe that some alternative to like the classic suit and tie jazz club model was going to be possible. She had basically begun hosting jam sessions, I think back as early as like the late 2000s at Zinc Bar, at a place called Creole, all over the city, but really developing like these sort of weekly residencies where musicians could do the kind of old school jazz jam thing And often it really was in seated clubs. So that kind of belies the notion that like it can't happen in clubs. But at the same time, it pushed up against a lot of the what we call the kind of expected etiquette of going to a jazz club. And I think by creating something that was both a publication platform, which was Revive Music, as well as a show presenting arm, and really getting the iconography down, really getting like the presentation down and like really speaking to people in a way that wasn't alienating to young listeners and didn't feel too closed off or too elevated for its own good. She was really able to, yeah, give musicians and also give audiences, and then also crucially give the other part of this whole ecosystem, which is the promoters and the playlist creators and the bookers. All of them took faith from what she did to think, oh yeah, there can be a new era here. And Don was of Blue Note Records is a great example, you know, brought her on board very early in his time there.
Two things that makes me think of. One, you wrote about Revive back in 2012. There's also a John Leland piece in the Times about Megan. I think it's from early 2013. And what's in that piece is very much what you're talking about, but also on the night or one of the nights that he's following her around, she does go literally from somewhere, I forget where it was, downtown, East Village, Lower East Side, to Dizzy's, like in the same night. Again, underscoring that there can be a narrative thread between the two. The other thing, and this is more philosophical, and it's something I kind of want to return to on a later episode of the show, which is, I can't overstate, and I think if you are listening and you are in a scene or a city that is not necessarily served by like centrist or mainstream media, having contemporaneous documentation, a publishing platform alongside a scene, whether it's Instagram coverage or a zine or a website or whatever, or a flyer that you hand out that covers old shows that happened and tells you what shows are about to happen. I can't overstate how important that is, not just for the historical record. Obviously, that's a hobby horse of mine. I always care about the historical record, but also as a tool of support to understand that like these things don't happen and escape into the void. They are captured, they're documented, they're taken seriously and passed along, not simply by being there, but by capturing it in words that other people can read and imagine what it was if they couldn't be there. So if you're in a town or in a place or in a scene that has a sound or a scene, but does not have a publication, start it. That's all I have to say. We'll come back to it on another episode. Anyway, please, Nate, take it away.
That's what I was going to say about Gio's comments. He used a word that I think is very important in this discussion, which is ecology. Or no, you said ecosystem.
I like ecology better.
I was going to morph that into ecology because Megan understood better than most that it's not just about putting shows on. Like most promoters, and I think that at least when she started out, that's what she was. She was a promoter. Most promoters don't think too much far beyond that. How do we get the musicians on a stage? How do we bring people to the show? And then how do we pay the musicians? How do I get a little money myself? Megan was thinking in much more holistic terms. I think the fact that the organization she founded was called Revive, she was thinking about the long-term health and the broad implications of a healthy ecosystem, which jazz did not have one, really. Certainly not for the generation of artists that she championed. It's funny, as we talk about this conversation about like the club, in quotes, right? I'm reminded of the fact that John Caramonica's favorite movie of the last 10 years is La La Land.
Rude.
Ooh, that is rude.
But you know, this is a movie that is ostensibly all about like, how do we save jazz? Jazz is in trouble. How do we save it? Ah, I know. I'll start a club. Like it's such laughable backward thinking, this idea that like, you know, sort of Field of Dreams, like not to mix my movie metaphors, but it's, you know, this idea of like, oh, jazz just needs like a swanky club. And then like all the problems will go away. And so obviously like that is just complete nonsense.
That's poppycock.
Indeed. As the John Legend character like kind of gently like informs the main character, Ryan Gosling, he's like, you didn't ask any musicians if that's what they really wanted, right?
Right.
And that's sort of what's beautiful about the Megan thing, about the whole way she went about her work and the way she even, like you said, sort of thought about it differently. Is that I think she's one of these figures who have always existed really in the music, but have not always necessarily had the initiative or the particularly broad-minded approach that she had. people who really are listening to the musicians first and who are working with the musicians alongside them and who are actually part of the community. You know, she had been at Berklee. She had been a musician herself. She was really somebody who trusted the musicians and whom they trusted as well. And I think it was because of that that she was so holistic, because she was saying, well, what do you need? Like, what's missing in your, like, if you're coming out of jazz school and you're like the next thing waiting to pop off, but you don't have anywhere to put that talent that feels natural to you, how can we fix this? So I think it was out of the obvious need for some gathering grounds where these musicians who were making this new kind of fusion of sounds into a new style, the need for that space was really what drove her. And then also the need, as you say, John, every scene needs a zine, right? Like every, like she basically realized that, like, if there was nobody to cover it, not only covering it, but covering it, and this is something that's sensitive for us as writers and critics, but like covering it from a position that the musicians felt comfortable. Because a lot of the time musicians don't love to read their name in the New, they love to read their name in the New York Times, but they don't always connect with how we might frame things, or they might in fact like be a little bit predisposed to disagree for whatever reason. But I think for her to create a platform, you know, no, never.
Couldn't imagine.
But I think did feel, whether or not we agree with that, I think it did feel really affirming for a lot of musicians to see their stuff put in lights on a DIY platform that maybe came from within the community. So I'm glad we're taking a moment to sort of think about how her work came from such a deep place for her, and then also did affect a bit of a paradigm shift in some ways.
And just to touch on that, I do think, and I agree, Gio, with what you're saying, and I'm sure we've all experienced this in different forms over the years, as far as how our framing or what we're writing about or how we're writing about what we're writing about may not always line up with how the folks are expecting it or are desiring it. And that doesn't simply have to do with whether it's good or bad, thumbs up or thumbs down. A lot of it can be framing issues. But I also think, like, and I know this is true for me, and I imagine it's probably true for y'all on some level. It's like when I was a younger writer, a lot of what I was doing was fundamentally what I would describe as advocacy journalism or advocacy criticism, especially in the 90s, where things that I cared about were often not reliably covered by mainstream outlets. And so, yes, I mean, yes, there were some things I liked and some things I didn't like, but also I wanted to use criticism as a platform to advocate for the things I thought should get more attention. I say that to say that, yes, that's different than maybe what all of us currently do for our career. But I also think as an entry point, if you're a young writer or if you're in a scene, that's a eminently fine entry point to start out with.
And especially in an era where social media has basically become the main mode of communication, the way you convey ideas is through advocacy, basically, on social media, right? It's like, oh, like I went to this thing and it was really cool. Or like, oh, you should really all come out to this. Or look at my, you know, my latest offering, whatever. She clearly saw that coming a little early, like that, like just sheer enthusiasm and support from within would be a kind of media that people would be excited about.
That's a really good point. And when I put myself back in that time, you know, 2011. I was just looking. Some of the earliest emails I got from Megan were 2011, about a year after she had started presenting shows. And I remember being really into the music and into the presentation, but kind of recoiling from the boosterism of the platforms. You know, like there'd be writing on The Revivalist, you know, and some of it was really good. And a lot of it I felt was not sufficiently rigorous, you know?
Sure, but that wasn't always the point.
I'm a little older and wiser now, and I think I understand now, like, oh, you know what? That was actually really valuable, you know, not only because it gave some people the space that the three of us had in alt weeklies back in the day, you know, but also because a scene needs that kind of feedback. And then hopefully everybody matures a little bit into something that is more like what we recognize as criticism.
I certainly learned about a lot of great music by reading about it when I was younger. And we forget sometimes, or especially as people, maybe not so much for me anymore, but it's like I used to be out five nights a week. So I could experience great music in real time, just make my decisions about it and feel what I wanted to feel. But when I was 16 or even 20 or 22, that wasn't the case. And sometimes you need a different entry point, a touch point, and writing, whether it's like criticism or advocacy writing or whatever it is, that can just have a potential for an exponential growth. And I think what you're just, what you guys are describing about Megan and her entire enterprise is this sense that, like, not only do I have to do what the musicians are needing, not only do I have to identify the physical spaces where that can happen, but I also want to tell that story in a way that if you're not in New York, if you can't get to these clubs, your interest might be piqued by, and maybe you'll seek it out and then grow an audience that way.
Since we're talking about venue as a sort of a organizing principle of this conversation, I want to also float this idea that sometimes when the space exists, it can accommodate different, you know, dissonances and like happy accidents and whatever. I think about the Village Vanguard in particular, which, you know, I will always consider the greatest jazz club on the planet. I used to, John, back in the day when I was going out five nights a week, usually one of those nights would be a Sunday at the Vanguard. You know, I lived in the West Village and it was kind of my neighborhood spot. And there was a time for a few years when it almost didn't matter who was playing. I would just go to the Vanguard on a Sunday because I knew that something worthwhile was going to happen to me. And some of what that entailed actually was between sets or after a set, just running into somebody, running into a musician or a fellow critic or somebody that I maybe didn't even know very well, like Stanley Crouch. And just like what would happen in that space? You know, what would happen when you had just witnessed the same musical expression? You had just lived with sound together in a room for an hour. And then you had both kind of opened yourself to this thing. And then here you are now like catching up, or maybe somebody's got a tip for you, or you're having an argument. And I feel like this is something that the roving space idea or the pop-up show or whatever, like just doesn't have, which is there's a cadence to it. There's this idea that like this is a space for encounters. And it only a few clubs have that really, but the ones that do, I think it's really valuable.
To push back a tiny bit, it's important to note that the people you mentioned, which is fine and great, but those are people who get comped. So those are musicians and fellow critics who basically were on the door list. Otherwise, if you were paying full freight to go to the Vanguard, I guarantee you wouldn't have been going every week. So there is that element.
Definitely not.
It's $40 plus whatever you drink.
It didn't used to be $40, though, I have to say. It was $25 back in the day.
I have to make my little post-Marxist like footnotes here, but like the point being that like the spaces that are cultivated are dictated in part by the crowds that are able to gather there. And I do think that part of the musician's frustration with these spaces that I heard is a lack of Black faces, to be perfectly frank, and a lack of non-tourists to go all the way there. However, there is something really important about having those gathering spaces where musicians themselves can kind of slide in and hang in the back and be community and share those experiences. You're right. And I think it is happening still at the Vanguard, still at the Blue Note, but I think it's also happening at some of these more alternative spaces, these standing rooms, these mixed genre venues that are also figuring out that like, oh yeah, like there's good enough money in putting on a kind of freeform radio approach to booking, right? Of like really great sort of artistically visionary like bookings that include jazz and include some IDM-ish and include like, I don't know, maybe Yellow Man, right? Who was just at New Blue the other day, or Public Records. Public Records is a spot that like, I find myself having that kind of experience, Nate, where like I'll go and I'll see the same people over and over, but it'll be kind of wildly different music. And you're right. Megan understood that there needed to be a constancy and that in fact, yeah, those residencies she established in venues were the things that musicians most often refer to as having had a meaningful effect. So I don't mean to say that like the outdoor kind of catch as catch can occasional springtime concert is going to replace the gathering space at the club. I simply mean that it's all valid, but that what Megan did was she maybe nudged forward the idea that musicians and their direct advocates should have a really determinative say in how this music is presented. And that when that happens, it's going to turn the jazz club upside down a little bit.
Yeah, we've seen the legacies of that. It's funny, Gio, when you published your piece, I was reminded that these things are kind of cyclical. And you acknowledge this in your piece. You talked about the loft scene in the 1970s. In 2006, which I think is the year that Megan Stabile came to New York City, I reported a piece for the weekend section of the Times about the Brooklyn jazz scene in terms of venues. And at the time, there was actually a reception to this piece that was like, you can go see jazz in Brooklyn? Really? It's not just where the musicians live. Like, you can actually go hear it.
And it was cafes and it was kind of funky spaces.
Exactly. There were, you know, there were a couple of spots that were like Zebulon, which was like a bar, but there was also like the Tea Lounge and there were these spaces that were kind of, yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course. On 7th Avenue. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's right. I saw some great shows at the Tea Lounge. And thankfully, Barbes is back and still vital. But now, when you look at like who's playing in the city, like on any given night, like half of the good shows are in Brooklyn, maybe more than half.
And almost none of those venues are the old model of jazz club.
Guys, I think my main takeaway is that y'all don't take me out enough. That's my main takeaway.
Let's go, man. Let's go.
Let's do it.
Nate, just to close out on something you said, which I actually want to expand on a little bit, which is you're talking about like the constancy of going to the Vanguard and like you never, the happenstance of it. You never know who's going to be in the room. The cadence of it dictates who shows up. And then what happens from there is like the unpredictable part, which I think is so valuable. And it's certainly something that I find anytime I go to like SOBs or whatever, you know, like, or, you know, Tramps back in the day or, you know, places like that. But also I think on Geo's side, you have wild, unexpected interactions when you go to like an arbitrary warehouse in the middle of nowhere and you don't know who's going to be there. And sometimes those conversations are as fruitful or unexpected or, you know, propitious as what would happen when you see the folks you know at SOBs. It cooks both ways. And I'm actually really happy that you took it to the level of it's not simply like we're going to like watch what's happening on stage. We're also going to immerse ourselves around other people who are either passionate or curious about the thing that we're passionate or curious about. And that's ultimately, I think, why we all do what we do, because we want to go to the thing, but we also want to chop it up after. Like, I think that's why we're all in this game. Yo, I appreciate it. Geo, a pleasure. Nate, OG gang, I'm happy you're here. A privilege to have you back. Guys, what do you want to go out on? What should we listen to?
Before we go out with music, I would like to go out with a little bit of service journalism, so to speak, and give people a list of venues that they might be interested in checking out if this conversation piqued their interest. And if they happen to be in or around New York City, Public Records is a good one to start off on. There's the Soapbox Gallery. There's, let's see, Barbes is a great example. The Owl Music Parlor. All of these are in Brooklyn. IRL Gallery, which is an art gallery that's been having all kinds of kind of wild shows. Man, I know I'm leaving so many off, but there's also, you know, on the more traditional jazz club tip, there's still so much great music happening at places like Mesro. You mentioned the Vanguard, Nate, Essential.
We have not brought up the Jazz Gallery, but we've got to here.
The Jazz Gallery is a place that is also just an example of a whole new model and totally fascinating. And we could have gone into a whole chapter and verse about that. But it's, you know, suffice to say, a nonprofit space that's doing a lot for musicians.
Can I jump in with a tip?
Yeah.
So, John, this is our next hang, I think, the three of us and some other assorted hooligans. I mentioned Ars Nova Workshop, and, you know, this is run by my good friend Mark Christman. For well over 10 years, they've been presenting in all kinds of spaces, high and low, in Philadelphia. During the pandemic, he acquired the lease to a beloved old honky-tonk called the Boot and Saddle, which closed as a result of pandemic pressures. This is an incredible room with a ton of history. And Mark has partnered up with a veteran bar proprietor in Philadelphia, and they are opening in September as a dedicated music venue and cafe. I'm sure that they will retain some of the grit, if not the sawdust on the floor.
The decor. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be pretty great.
I have car. We'll travel. I'm with it. Geo, we'll hop in the car and we'll drive on down.
Let's do it.
What's a song that we should go out with? Geo, what do you got?
Well, Julius Rodriguez is a young pianist, multi-instrumentalist, kind of came out of this moment of convergence and fracture that we've been dissecting. He's got a really good album that's just come out, and on it, he covers a Stevie Wonder tune, All I Do. The vocalist Mariah Cameron is on it with him. So let's finish up with that.
That's our show. Again, Geo, Nate, thank you so much. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me at podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Y'all want to have a jazz meetup in the city, you let us know. We'll make it happen. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio. That's Apple, that's Google, that's Stitcher, and wherever all else. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. Here's some Julius Rodriguez for you.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.